Okay, so I'd like to, in a moment, invite Jay Griffiths to come and speak, our speaker for this evening. And how many of you have read one of Jay's books? Wild is one of them. Yeah, not so many of you. Jay's written this really extraordinary book called Wild, which maybe I'm sure she'll say more about later, maybe not. Where she went on this extraordinary journey to the wild places of the earth and connected with the energies and the ways of those different places. I think it was over really quite a long period of time, 7 years. So that book is 7 years of Jay's life. An extraordinary work and very connected to the elements and elemental territory. So I'd just like to warmly welcome you, Jay, and thank you very, very much for coming, and hand over to you.
Thanks very much for that introduction. The first thing that I want to do, because it's just too tempting, and this is a church, is to tell you a joke that my father used to tell us when we were kids, which is this this Bible-bashing minister in a church who would say, "And in the last days there will be a weeping and a gnashing of teeth." And there's a little guy in the back row who goes, excuse me, Father, but what about those who have no teeth? Teeth will be provided. So that was not what I meant to start with at all. You're probably quite pleased to know. What I want to talk about is an idea which I call the politics of kindness, because I think in all of these areas of sort of environmentalism, the kind of transition movement, how one is political in some very deep ways that are quite often absolutely not party political, that to me that kind of idea that there could be a politics of kindness, which actually is a very good way of judging the usefulness of different ideas and different policies. Can I just check, can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Right. No, one person can't.
Is it just...
Do you? Yes, it is. Come and sit in the front. Okay. And I want to talk about the idea of wild kindness, because kindness is not a characteristic that's much valued by modernity. At best, it's portrayed as if it's a kind of pastel quality, as if it's something meek and mild and tame. At worst, it's portrayed as if it's foolish, that kindness is a naive characteristic in this dog-eat-dog world. But to me, though, it's the opposite. The kindness is not tame and it's not foolish. It's both very wild and very wise. The way of the wild is kind. In its etymology, what is kind is natural. The word kind stems from gekind in Anglo-Saxon. It's a noun which means, amongst other things, nature. And the adjective gekinder translates as natural, innate, genial, suggesting beautifully that we are born innately kind. Our wild ancestors needed kindness as much as food, for a law of kindness towards their own kind was the only way that they could survive. Life was full of small children and young fires to be tended, big game which could be hunted only cooperatively, and in that entirely unsentimental tenderness of the tribe, people would know that to help someone else is to help yourself. The prevailing idea of the kind of nasty, brutal, wild caveman seems to me motivated by a kind of social vanity in order to claim that progress has led to the apex of us. So what is most natural is most wild. What is most natural, most kinder, is most kind. Shakespeare's Timon of Athens illustrates the unkindness of the unnatural world of wealthy civilization when Timon comments, "Timon will to the woods, where he shall find the unkindest beast, more kinder than mankind." To the woods, we'll be coming back to that. But more on kindness. Wild creatures hunt and kill, but they do not act unkindly to humiliate other creatures. What is wild needs cage nothing, mock nothing. The kill is swift, the motive simple hunger. Cases of cruelty in the animal world are rare. They may be non-existent. But if you want to make a wild animal learn cruelty, you put it in a cage. I became interested in exploring the relationship between wildness and kindness when I was writing Wild, which Joe mentioned earlier. It's a book which is about wildnesses of all kinds, and it was a book which began in the woods, in the forests, in the jungles of the Amazon. And the history of Europeans' actions in the Amazon, their murders and extinctions and loggings and land theft, is a demonstration of radical unkindness, the unmaking of the wild. But behind those actions is the Western philosophy of a terrible unkindness, the idea that the human animal is a different kind of creature, entirely separate from others. The Native American Luther Standing Bear said, "The old Lakota was wise. He knew that man's heart, away from nature, becomes hard. He knew that lack of respect for growing living things soon led to lack of respect for humans too. So he kept his youth close to its softening influence." And in many hunting societies, animals are considered kin and must be treated kindly. For hundreds of years, though, the dominant culture has pumped out the lie that what is wild is unkind. And it's a lie of consequence. For imputing unkindness to the wild world justifies a murderous attitude towards it. It's like dehumanizing your enemy to justify a genocide. And European philosophy, which sought to place mankind higher than animals and outside nature, manufactured this ferocious hatred of wildness. The word kindle, which has been so horribly misappropriated by some, to me, a vile piece of technology, excuse me, I prefer paper. Anyway, but the word to kindle, meaning to bring forth young, has the same Old English root as kind, gekinder. And all the wild processes of life are generative, regenerative, genial, kind. The Arctic ice kindling polar bear cubs in a den. Earth, like a wild cat, kindling kittens in her hot womb. Kindness kindles life. And to be kind is to be part of the boisterous, generous, creative life. To be unkind is anti-natural. So kindness is nothing less than a force of nature. Meek and mild, it is not. It springs from the loins. It brings forth young. It's a lust within all wild things, a lust to kindle. The will to make kind, not only as strong as the will to make love, but actually, in the word's root, identical with it. To be kind is on the side of life. Fucking lovely, kind, wild life. And this is where we're all canny in wild knowledge, canny in the country of kindness. Because within us all, as the wild animals we are, is a hot, kindled kindness. And in that wildness within, the wisdom. For all of human history, people have engaged with the world through some form of community. This is part of our social evolution. So it's as if somewhere deep inside us all, there's a kind of archived treasure, the knowledge of what it is to be part of a community via extended families, locality, village, common land, unions, faith communities, language communities, cooperatives, gay communities, even virtual communities, which for all their unreality still reflect a yearning for a wider home for the collective soul. And many people today experience a strange hollow in the psyche, a hole the size of a village. But for hundreds of years, nation-states have attacked communities. In Britain, earliest and most emblematic were the enclosures. And when governments passed laws to privatise common land, the spirit of collectivity was undermined as surely as the sight of it. The vicious system of reservations for Native Americans robbed people of their communities of land and stole from them their communal identity. Indigenous people all over the world have found their language communities assaulted until they can't even speak. There is no such thing as society. The most sociopathic lie ever uttered by a British Prime Minister. And if you've got some quotes that you'd like to volunteer in a competition afterwards that beat that, I'd love to hear them. There is no such thing as a society, was Thatcher's summing up as she broke the unions. And for decades, agribusiness has destroyed the lives and dignity of campesinos in South America, while neoliberalism, we know, has wreaked havoc on communities across the world. And then there are the seemingly trivial examples, the mass closures of pubs, for example, which tear the fabric of the lives of so many communities. In the long fetch of the wave, then, the transition initiative is a new formulation of a very old idea, because we are gloriously social animals. We flock, we gather, we chirp, we howl, we sing, we call, we listen. And if the transition initiative is empowering for communities, that's because there's an enormous latent energy there to be tapped, so that communities may be authors of their own story. One of the things that I really admire about the whole transition movement is the mending of clothes, tending of vegetables, the restoring of furniture, because those kind habits are very gentle verbs. To restore is restorative, to tend involves tenderness, to mend hints at amends, and there is restitution here of community itself. One thing which communities do very well is to think collectively. Folk tales, for example, are great examples of collective thought. So is the collective wisdom of herbalism and other kinds of medicine. Language itself is collective wisdom. There's a great term for language that Ralph Waldo Emerson said, that language is fossil poetry, because it's collected with the wisdom of years and years of being spoken. There is a sense of kindness in this, of a way of thinking which includes an enormous diversity of people's views. But amongst many indigenous cultures, there is also an idea that it's not only humans who can think. Shamans in particular, indigenous people in general, perceive that animals have their own ways of knowing. A jaguar may have its way of thinking, and some plants can teach humans. This is a real intellectual humility, to be willing to learn from plants. And these plants are sacred, honoured, and stolen, patented by pharmaceutical companies. But wondering what a snail is thinking, or what a tree might feel, is part of a relationship of empathy between humans and the natural world. And children who are faithful to anthropomorphism until they're ridiculed out of it, children actually nurture a fuller relationship with the animal world than the empty, metallic relationship typical of many of us adults. So children become party to extra sensitivities, to other stories and a diversity of viewpoints. This is not childish, because to use more nuanced sensitivities, greater complexity and increased diversity is an aspect of mature thinking. Indigenous cultures realise that watching wild things is not only a good way of learning how to hunt, but learning how to think. The dominant culture, though, has pushed an agenda which devalues other human societies' ways of thinking and scorns the idea that nature might be minded. Further, it has a nasty habit of urging individuals to argue relentlessly for their point, as if being right is a product of individual people. Someone once said, in an argument where everyone is right, everyone should be shot. And I think it was Ian Hamilton Finley, but I googled it recently and I couldn't find it. Anyway, I think it's a wonderful line, an argument where everyone's right, everyone should be shot. Because being right, it seems to me, is not an individual fact, but a collective process. It's like that beautiful Quaker saying, as I'm sure most of you know, that every one of us carries a piece of the truth. My own favourite version of this is to ask in a situation, you know, what is our collective wisdom on this? I was recently had to get a lot of work done on my house because the slates were coming off the roof. The rain was coming in through the walls and the doors didn't close. And I was working with four friends who between them had about 100 years of building experience. But they all had slightly different attitudes to exactly what would work in each situation. And so what we do is to say, what is our collective wisdom about this? And then it would all kind of chip in. It assumes a plurality. It assumes that you can get the best answer collectively. I think one of the things that, when I said we were coming back to the woods, is that woods and forests and trees have often been used to represent a way of thinking, a form of thought, and actually have got a kind of political underlying nature to them. The redoubtable Vandana Shiva said, from the forests we learnt democracy, that every species has its place. And we speak of the roots of words like the roots of trees, the roots of meaning going down into the earth of the past. And the roots of the words for tree go right back down into darkness, even before Latin. Go right back down into the dreamtime language known as Indo-European, the root language from which Indian and European languages branch out. There is a word base, Deru, from which we get Tari. We also, from the same word root, Deru, not only get Tari, but we also get the word Taru, which I think is the most beautiful idea, suggesting that something which is true is as solid as a tree. Some of the other words, incidentally, are trust and tryst and endure and betroth. And all of these words are related to that base word, deru, which means tree. The tree of knowledge is well known. The Buddha meditated under a tree and sought wisdom from it. In the early years of Buddhism, it was thought that certain spirits of the trees lived in the tree trunks and spoke from there. In the Amazon, a Desana elder once said, the Amazon forest itself is a wide expanse similar to a perceptive human head. It seems that everywhere in the world people have associated tree and thought, idea and forest. But I think one of the things also that is important about the idea of trees being good to think with is actually how we use our minds and which part of the mind it is that has different dispositions towards the world. There's a really interesting book called The Master and His Emissary. Has anybody come across it? which I think is absolutely fascinating. It's talking about the way that the brain has its left hemisphere disposition and way of looking at the world, and its right hemisphere disposition and way of looking at the world. The left hemisphere is very good at making things, getting things, tool making. The right hemisphere is very good at things like empathy, the valuing of the natural world, and it's extremely good at metaphor. It's as if the right hemisphere of the brain perceives the world with a kind of imaginative leap, as if it can feel through the bodies of others. Metaphors prowl around the mind. Wanting to step out of the human world and into the animal world follows exactly the same pattern as wanting to step out of literal speech into metaphoric speech, where one's mind is a whole world of utterly unfensible freedom, where with a flick of letters, like as if, everything is radiant with the possibilities of elseness. And it seems to me that climate change requires the best metaphor makers, messengers who can tell the stories of things unimagined, making immediate the experience of people unknown, of people indeed unborn. And art can do this, collapsing distance, creating the empathy of nearness. Art so close it leaves its eyelash on your cheek as it passes. Rebalancing the relationship between human communities and the natural world is a feature of shamanism, and artists play that same role in response to the unbalanced chaos of climate. Like traditional shamans, artists are required to play a role of kindness. I don't want, by the way, to give the impression that only artists understand metaphor or speak in that language, because we all do. It's a beloved part of the workings of the human mind. And I'd also like very much to say I'm very glad and grateful to have been asked to do this talk, and I'm particularly glad that the invitation did not include being told that I would be with a group of like-minded people. Because if somebody tells me that there's a group of like-minded people, I feel like bopping them on the nose. Like-minded, alike. What would the world look like if we were all like-minded? It's like some ghastly forestry plantation of look-alike pine trees. The human eye detests that. It looks for the lovely diversity of a natural forest. And in terms of human personality, just as much as in the personality of forests, diversity is crucial. Biodiversity in nature and biodiversity in human nature. It seems to me that in terms of any kind of activism, any kind of community, any kind of movement, diversity is of the essence. My own first political engagement was up trees in the road protest movement. And one of the arguments which raged and raged was between the people who ran the office doing very sensible things with bits of paper and those who threw themselves in front of the bulldozers. Because to the bulldozeries, everyone should be a bulldozeree. And to the sensible paper people, everyone should be a sensible paper person. And clearly, the movement was at its best with both those roles, and with every role besides, with the sweet old ladies who invited the MP for tea and cake to chat about the bypass, and the role of the musicians around the fire pit, and the role of the lawyer, and the role of the journalist, and the role of the joker, and the cook, and the amazing person who put up rules for teepee etiquette. And I am serious about that. A community or a movement where everyone is the same is not a functioning community. It's a club. And it may be quite good fun to be in a club for a while, but they're pretty deadly in the end. A community, though, which invites human diversity while sharing a common cause, can thrive. And indeed, in terms of chosen communities or movements, the ones which do thrive are the ones with a common cause, whether that's a shared spirituality or shared politics. But no movement works if everyone demands that everyone else is the same as them. And I think there's a really crucial distinction here between sameness and commonness. Because commonness, holding values in common, holding a purpose in common, is exactly what movements need. But that commonness is best achieved by diversity and not by sameness. And I think to me, as part of that idea of diversity and selfhood, but it seems to me that selfhood is something wild and vigorous and green and expressive and curly. The unique strength and energy of selfness is irreplaceable. Myself, it speaks and spells, crying out, "What I do is me, for that I came." Hopkins wrote that, Gerard Manley Hopkins, not the other Hopkins. Selfhood wants to speak its name. And if selfness has a quality of wildness, each unique, self-willed and different entity, then kindness is what binds each wild self to each other. Kindness binds each wild and different self to each other. Because we're all different and wildly ourselves. And when I talk of wild kindness, it is the wildness as well as the kindness that matters. The wild self. And what is wild cannot be bought or sold, cannot be borrowed or copied. It is unmistakable, unforgettable, unshameable, elemental. Don't waste your wildness. It is precious and necessary. In wildness is truth. Wildness is the universal songline sung in green gold, which we recognize the moment we hear it. What is wild is what drives the honeysuckle, what wills the dragonfly, what shoves the wind and compels the poem. Wildness is insatiable for life. Neither truly knows itself without the other. Wildness is the luminousness of a bluebellwood at twilight, massive clouds boiling up their rain, the weed which cracks the pavement, and the river which floods the banks, the creeping jenny run riot. Wildness simmers in the feral intoxication of jazz. It explodes exuberant in carnival. It honks with laughter. It smashes the clocks above the factory gates and sucks up the now. It blazes in your eyes, and it glories in everyone who willfully goes their own way. Because we come from that wild song, in music was the creation of the universe. And we are most fully alive when we resonate to its wildest pitch with intense and necessary love. Because humanity's highest and kindest purpose is to be fluent in the streaming cadences of all our world's languages, making our earth more vivid, realizing it in song. For that is how the spirit, deep within all life, leaves the unforgeable signature of its wild and kind authenticity in the songlines of this wild world. Thank you.
Just put that in. Thank you very much, and I agree very much with what you had to say about diversity within communities and the commonness. I'm not so convinced, I have to say, about wildness and kindness and humanity and cruelty. From my experience, which isn't that much, but with animals, basically looking at studies of animals in the wild and that, I think particularly in the apes, there is humiliation, etc., within groups. It's one of the methods of control, as it is in our groups. So I think I would perceive that there is bad and good, both within humans and within the wild, and I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I would love to see how you would demonstrate that. I mean, obviously, I understand that there are issues of kind of like, you know, pecking order in different groups of primates and things like that. I would really, really, really like to know how you would understand or how you would infer that that involved humiliation. I could certainly see that kind of, you know, that throughout the animal world, there are issues of kind of, you know, power standoffs absolutely everywhere. But where it actually becomes an issue of cruelty, I think it's really interesting, and I would love to know what it is that you would say is a matter of cruelty and humiliation. That's what I'd say.
Hello, I read your book Wild. I read Wild 3 times last year.
Oh, you can come again!
I read it at the time when I really needed to feel the wildness in me. And I was very taken in the book about the split that you didn't talk tonight about, but about the split between the wild and the settled. And I wonder what your thoughts are on how we can encourage the settled to be more wild and kind, because it's the settled who are all the same, who think the same things, drive the same cars, go on the same holidays, put up with the same bitterness and humiliation from the people who choose to govern us. And yet, if a movement like this transition movement is to change, then it has to change the minds of millions and millions of settled people. Is that through the return to community roots?
How do you know, I think this is a question which is better a statement, and I think you should carry on. That's what
I really don't know. I don't know. I mean, the work that I do is helping people to change their minds one by one. And I just love a quicker route than that. You know, I think your way of writing for me is poetically powerful and certainly helped bring out the wildness in me after probably years of getting really quite settled. But also I know that if I've read your book 3 times, I've bored all of my friends with it. I've told them to read it and they haven't. But, you know, if people could read your book, I think that would change things. But it's almost like, is there a quick way to get through to people who are terribly settled to their own detriment?
I think that's a really important thing. I think one of the things in my book that I've written about is the whole issue of the way that in European cultures, the establishment, interesting term for, you know, the settled and the powerful, has had a hatred of nomadism in all its forms, that, you know, of nomadic indigenous people, you know, the way that, for example, Aboriginal Australians were treated, and absolutely not them alone, but for their nomadic lifestyles. But also you could say that the feature of nomadism within attacks on the poor through the anti-vagrancy laws and, you know, the kind of anti-vagabond laws. It's a very interesting history of, like, how the establishment has hated allowing movement. And actually, obviously, kind of, you know, the movement as a fact and movement as a metaphor is a crucial part of who we are as humans. And it's how we live best, and it's how we learn.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jay, I haven't read Wilde, but I'm here next. He's told me to read it, but I have been given selected highlights read at me. And the one in particular, this isn't really a question, but I just want to thank you for the observation, is the camping one, where, you know, there's the bit about tents versus caravans, and the whole caravan is just a... It doesn't, it's not, you know, it doesn't move.
Static.
Static caravan. Yeah, thank you. It's just a brilliant observation and one that we often, you know, talk about when we're in our tent.
With the Wilton, I walk past and say, you're the apotheosis of turgidity.
Thank you. I couldn't remember the quote as it's great. Thank you.
I'm mute. This isn't really a question this is a question for the last speaker but one, because I think this is a rather important point which I often hear people making, that how are we going to change the world? And any group seems to have this agenda that it has to kind of effect a change in the opinion of the majority. And personally, I think that's a distraction from the work that we have to do, which is creating solutions in a small way and putting them into practice so that they work. We are not about changing opinion on a large scale, and I don't think we should be distracted into feeling that. If you think about the point of an arrowhead, and that's a bit of a violent metaphor perhaps, but anything which has a leading edge is by definition a small area in comparison to the rest of the body that follows it, if you like. And we are only going to be a small group, and it's the Mary Mead quotation. Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world, because it's the only thing that ever has. I don't think we should waste energy on worrying about changing opinions. We should be concerned with doing what we can do as we are.
If anybody, by the way, does want to kind of, you know, just make statements rather than questions, please do, because you've all been listening to me for quite a while, and I'd be really happy if, you know, it was more of a conversation as you've just made it.
Okay, this is kind of halfway between a statement and a question. Okay, so I've been thinking about the relationship between chaos and the wild, and would love to ask a question about that. So in ancient Greece, Chaos was the goddess who dwelt in the space between the village and the forest, and you had to move through chaos to get from the domesticated into the wild. And I'm kind of wondering if you've thought about that, and I'm kind of wondering also if transition should invoke chaos as the goddess of transition.
I think that's absolutely lovely. I think that's absolutely lovely. I think that's really, it's very interesting as well, because the shamanic role, you know, in traditional societies, and shamanism is something that's been everywhere, all around the world, wherever there's earth, there's been shamanism. And the role of the shaman is to take the edge. It's quite often to live on the edge, but it's to take the role of the edge, because it's a move between worlds, that role. And I think that you know, that sense of the necessary chaos is really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. Oh,
it's very loud.
Hi. Over here.
I'm sorry.
Wow, I can throw my voice amazing.
I think the way that you described kindness, that you did it in such a poetic way, I thought it was really beautiful. I found you quite dreamy, and I kept drifting in and out, and I may have missed. No, because you always hear what you're meant to hear, so that's the important thing. But I possibly miss, and if I haven't, then that's good. Could you do the same kind of definition for wild or wildness? Could you do that?
I think it's a really, really, really difficult question, and I think it's one of those where, to me, I've never been prepared to say, this is the definition and this is not. And what I prefer to do is to say, how fantastic, look at how many different definitions there are. But my favourite is the relationship of the word wild with the word will.
That's what I was thinking.
Yes, exactly. And it's really interesting because at that point what you get is the idea of a wild land as self-willed land and of a wild creature as something which is self-willed. And obviously then in human terms that's got a really powerful political undercurrent to it of it is, you know, it's the quality of being self-ruled.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, as people are drifting out, and then some people want to ask more questions, if maybe if anyone's needing to... You're all right here? Okay.
Thank you. I also wanted to thank you for the poetry. My 15-year-old stepson recently made a very funny film with his school friend in which he played the part of a resurrected Adolf Hitler being interviewed on television. And the theme he chose to pick up on was the contrast of the unkindness of Hitler with his kindness to animals. And I just wanted to ask you about this ability to be, you know, to be so kind that's in some people alongside extreme unkindness. And perhaps not the extreme example of Hitler, perhaps, but it's there to some extent in all of us, I guess.
I think probably, you know, to me it's also that thing of, you know, where the sphere of oneself, where you perceive that to extend and where you don't, which is why, you know, you can have somebody who's, you know, as kind of evil as a Hitler, having elements within his life of kindness, the closer they were to himself. But I think one of the things that is, to me, is really interesting about, indigenous philosophy, not just indigenous philosophies, but it's very clear in indigenous philosophies, is that idea of kind of, you know, where that the self actually extends through into other people, other societies, other animals, you know, and the world. And you could also say the same about, you know, transcendentalist philosophy. It's that idea of kind of, you know, the extension of the self, not in an egotistical way, but in the sense of what becomes in the purview of your responsibility. That it's not just, you know, your own body, your own family, your own house. It's then your own village, your community, your land, your climate, you know, and so it goes on and on.
That's why I'm suspicious when I hear people talk about them, because they're presumably the people outside of our sphere. And you can say, when you hear someone say them or they, there's a reason to be suspicious, I think.
Hi. It's kind of going back a few points, but that idea of... I come from a family of people who tend to move around quite a lot, and I've noticed that I move around quite a lot. And I've almost seen that as maybe a bad thing, because it feels like I'm not rooted in one place, and we're always talking about community and placed community as being really important. So it sort of struck me when you talked about the nomadic way as a positive thing. So I'm just wondering how those almost contradictory things fit together, and can you give advice of how transition communities could have aspects of nomadicness that would be positive?
I think one thing that is very interesting about the practice of nomadism is that
you know, normally, historically, within cultures, it's been nomadism within rootedness. So there will be a territory that people will move around within, and that territory is where it's known and respected and used. But the style of the style of being is still in motion. And I really don't give advice. It's like that makes me feel like, well, how should I know better than you?
Well, I suppose maybe examples of peoples that you've lived with.
But I think it's also kind of, you know, in oneself, you know the, you know, the importance of what it is to be rooted, and you know the importance of what it means, you know, to, you know, to move. And, you know, that you can know these things psychologically. It's like there's that beautiful line, I think it's Blake, who says, expect poison from standing water. And it's kind of, you know, that's, you know, if rootedness is really beautiful, a kind of rootedness with no motion whatsoever can be a sump. Just
off the top of my head. So, there's just, I think we'll just have two more questions and then three more questions and then round it up. Is that full? Otherwise, I think we'll be going too late.
Yeah. Thank you. When we peel away layers and illusions, we do find it's easy to be kind to each other as individuals. We recognise that we're of the same kind. My question is, do you think there can be such a thing as a kind organisation?
Yeah, I do.
And what form would it take? There's lots of organisational forms. We know that some of our problems come from corporations which are geared to make money and so on, but there's plenty of other more benign organisational forms. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think probably what I'd say is I have never specifically thought about it, and it sounds like you have, so I think you should say what you think.
Well, it's
sigh first.
I don't feel that a charitable model is appropriate because a charity sort of creates an us and them and the power and the less powerful. It's got to be something that creates a we, but there is a mechanism for doing things and tapping into the power of lots of individuals dealing with other organisations. I haven't thought about it very much. But I think it needs thinking about, because so much of what gets done is done through organisations or individuals acting through organisations. But there's another level of organisations to organisations that happens a lot.
I think if I was going to pick one organisation which I think is just amazing and has got kindness written through every single part of it, it's an organisation called Kids Company in London. I don't know if you've ever heard. Yes, lots of nods. It's absolutely phenomenal as a way of caring for some of the most hurt and abused and neglected kids in London. And it's got humour and real love and art and colour written into every single aspect of what they do. And interestingly, when they first set up, they got into big trouble because it didn't fit the proper pattern of organisations. But it is a really, really kind and good one.
My comment and perhaps question follows on very neatly from what you just said. As a person who's had quite a lot of experience in education, particularly special education, My sadness is that we're suppressing any wildness that our children have within them. We have all these sort of irrational fears imposed upon us. And how many children have any experience, and even this most tiny smidgen of wildness? We've been paid just... I'm on my hobby horse now. We've paid lip service to it by the introduction of things like forest schools. But it's almost like a sanitised package of wildness. So how can we actually let our children just experience a little bit of wildness?
I think that's a really, really good point. It's actually the book that I'm writing at the moment is about that. And one of the things that fascinated me in the research, when I was doing the research for the book, is that in 1 year, I think it might have been 2005 or something, that more children were injured falling out of bed than injured falling out of trees. And I thought, this is wrong.
I'm not quite sure my question is anymore. I just kept thinking about the wild places and how there are less and less of those, and there are more and more of us, and how so many of us don't have any access to wild places anymore. And so, you know, what does that mean?
Well, I'd say all of us have access to wild places because we are wild, because we don't have to be anywhere or go anywhere or to know it. We're wild as soon as we open our mouths because language is wild. To me, it's like, you know, what I'm talking about in talking about wildness is actually everything which is vibrant and alive. And that includes our emotions, it includes our humour, it includes our sexuality, it includes language. It's like, and in that sense, I'd say, you're lying in bed and you're in a wilderness. Lucky you. You know, and then a window box is a wilderness, even if you might have to kind of like, you know, make certain alterations of scale.
Feels like a really great place to pause. So really, thank you very much, Jay, for your wonderful talk.